Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for MacBreak Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is MacBreak Weekly, episode 74 for January 22nd, 2008. Hot Lips and Hawkeye. MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/MacBreak. And by listeners like you. Thanks for your donations. Welcome to MacBreak Weekly. It's the Hawkeye and Hot Lips episode. And who's Hot Lips? Are you Andy?
I want to be Hawkeye.
Yeah, but I would love to be Hot Lips.
Everybody wants, you want to be Hot Lips? Okay, Merlin Mann gets to be Hot Lips. Andy Anako's Hawkeye, and I'll be Radar O'Reilly. Everyone has the flu except the three of us. Actually, and sound a little like Radar today.
Where did they get
and
the flu?
And now we got to run the whole 4077 by ourselves.
And I'm patient zero. The vector that get everybody sick.
Everybody kept running up and licking your microphone, and I was all, seriously, don't do that. Leo's a very sick man.
Yeah, actually, I think that's what happened. Alex Lindsay used my headset mic, which probably was a foolish thing to do after I used it, coughed all over it. I don't know what Chris Breen's excuse is, but he's out. They're both down with the count, and the same thing I had. Andy and Merlin miraculously avoided any infection at all.
Well, we might be replicants.
Well, no, there are good reasons for that. I was Tony Shalhoubing my way through bottles of Purell like no one's business. I was like an alcoholic with these little bottles. If I even thought about human contact, that was good for a dime's worth of rubbing. Also, I had to teach myself to make sure I keep a handkerchief in my pocket at all times, because there are times when you just got to scratch your eyes or you got to rub something off. Anytime I touched my face, it was through a close contact.
Well, if you were Tony Shalhoub, then Merlin Mann must be Howie Mandel.
What? I don't want to be Howie Mandel.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're Hot Lips.
I'm Hot Lips. And, you know, before I had a daughter, I used to wash my hands approximately quarterly. But we decided that we wanted to keep her healthy. And so I started with the hand washing. I'm not going to jinx myself, but I think it does make a difference.
Oh, I do. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's the three of us.
This Week in Contagion.
There's probably just about enough. Yeah, This Week in Contagion. TWiC. It's a new show. There's probably about enough information for three people anyway. I mean, after all, we're just coming off Macworld. What more can you say?
Oh, we can say that it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Every time that there's a little fellow who's tolling in the fields, we'll be there. Every time there's the bulls are against the hobos, we'll be there.
Is that Steve Jode?
Well, we were suffering a little bit of Grapes of Wrath there in San Francisco.
Now, I think actually it was a very successful Macworld. Everybody's very happy. There was no, iPhone update, which is kind of a surprise. I guess he'll save that for another day.
I gotta say that, I was one of, I think, many people who were thinking, oh God, well, I suppose if I can't get a refund on my hotel and my airfare, I guess I'm going to go anyway. Cause everyone pretty much knew what was going to be announced. Yeah. We were all about 95% correct. And there was nothing there that was going to be, I must touch the hem of your robe for you had a demo of the new, right. of the new MacBook. But yet it was really, really awesome. I think most of that is due to the work of Paul Kent and his staff. I mean, the show just keeps getting better and better, more solid each and every
Paul
year.
Paul Kent's the IDG guy who puts this together.
Absolutely. He is the hand that pulls the strings.
And Kathy did an amazing job. It's funny. I as much as I had such a wonderful experience as a speaker, a lot of people did complain about some of the kind of strangely cattle-like moments in the Western Hall where there was complete gridlock of people like trying to leave the keynote as others were trying to get badges. But the speaker, from a speaker standpoint, man, they make you feel like a king.
Yeah. I'm still going through my bag of swag.
You know, it was really, I love those moments where I feel really, really stupid, but for great reasons. We've all gone through the passion play of my hard drive crash. One of the little side effects was that I could no longer use my big 8 gigabyte memory card that was in my camera because on Sunday, the day before the crash, I was out all day taking pictures during a walk in San Francisco. I'd obviously deleted all the pictures off of the card and put them onto the hard drive. And so I wasn't worried because I knew that, okay, well, I just won't use that card anymore because I have a utility at home that can recover them. Right. And of course, then I wind up later in the week knowing that I'm going to be spending like two or three hours taking a behind the scenes tour of Alcatraz and think, oh God, I really need that card. And then I'm just sort of triaging the stuff in my speakers bag. And lo and behold, there is a utility in there, a commercial utility for recovering stuff off of memory cards.
And clicks, right?
Exactly. And 2 hours later, Bob's your uncle. I had all my pictures back on the new hard drive and I had a brand new erased memory card.
So that worked pretty well, that clicks program.
That was pretty good. I mean, people were joking about the quantity of iPod cases that were in that bag. Suffice to say that I traveled with like 3 or 4 different iPods for all different things, and
used them all.
I had new things on at least 3 of them, but it's a really hefty assortment of really cool stuff. Even the stuff that I can't use myself, it's like there are going to be a lot of very happy nieces and nephews and sisters in New England.
Anybody install Office the new Office yet?
Oh, brother, did I?
And?
Oh, man. Like I said on the Twitter, man, make yourself at home, Office. Come on in. Put your feet on the couch. French kiss my wife. Because now I got the icons. They're crazy with the icons down in the dock. That drives me nuts. I don't like the dock. To me, that's
and they're
my
ugly point. Icons. I don't know why they have such ugly icons.
Oh, God. And then all of a sudden, I'm getting this insane jewel-toned Entourage pop-up menu of events from 2006, and I'm just like, how do I turn this merry-go-round off, you know? But and the new word, I don't know, it's gonna take me a while to get my head around that.
Hey, at least it's Intel though. I mean, that's I think a big improvement, right?
I suppose it still feels I have not launched it enough, so I'm talking out of my butt a little, but it still feels like it ain't like opening TextMate. That's all I'm saying. It's know what I mean?
You know, also they're releasing this in a very, very funny time. When they released the previous version of Office, they truly had the entire category all to themselves. There was no competition. There was Mariner Wright, there was Nicest Writer, there were a couple little fringe alternatives out there. But now they're releasing the new version of Word in a world in which Pages is here and it actually is a very good program. They're releasing it in a world where there are specialist word processors like Scrivener that are really, really quite good. I haven't installed it yet. And remember that, again, because of the crash, I've been installing every time I build a new hard drive or get a new machine like this, it's like a brand new season of Survivor where all the apps that I've had installed for the past 2 or 3 years have to re-earn their position on the hard drive because I only...
It's like reapplying for your own job.
I like that. That's the best part about losing a hard drive is starting over.
It's like the only time I reinstall a program is the first time I thought, oh God, I need that. I really, really need that. So BB Edit goes on really, really quickly. Omni Outletter goes on really, really quickly. Firefox. I have yet to install Word because I have Pages on there and I have Scrivener on there and I have BB Edit on there. And I've yet to, and probably because at this point, this is one of those like 3 or 4 week periods when I don't have to work on a book. I find that I can live quite nicely without Word. And I think that numbers will do quite nicely for me as a spreadsheet program. And I think that there's enough suffering in my life, self-inflicted, that I don't need to inflict any more suffering on myself with a brand new, unproven, untested version of Office that seems to be moderately as annoying as Real Player is in terms of the amount of trouble it makes for you when you just wanted to, you know, do one simple thing for you.
I have a friend who's really believes in social engineering. I will not name him, but I use him as an example in talks often because he's doing some disruptive stuff inside of a big company. There's two things that he does that I think is fantastic. One of the things he does is if you send him an invitation to anything with the default 1 hour meeting, he'll send it back to you and with a shorter time. And second, if you send him anything that he can't open in text edit, he sends it back to you. Now, is he being a jerk? Maybe, maybe not. But what he's saying is, I mean, I think it's really interesting to start thinking about what is there in Word that I need that's not in text edit. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much, you know, it's sort
well,
of
it's not
your
even
point,
safe
Andy.
To be circulating doc files. Well,
okay, number one,
in terms
word
of the
count.
Macros
yeah,
and stuff like that.
It's not even safe.
Yeah. But it's a really good point, Andy. And I think you're actually bringing up something kind of interesting. All of these really quotidian applications that we always had kind of ceded to very large companies, drawing programs, write programs, spreadsheet programs. These are all things that we're seeing an explosion in really interesting development. I mean, God, look at drawing and painting programs alone. I mean, for years, you just ceded that to Photoshop and Illustrator. I mean, in my opinion, and to a certain extent, Freehand. But now look at all the stuff like Acorn popping up. And what's that one that all the kids like with the HUD view that everybody likes?
Pixelmator.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think it's really fascinating that, to me, this just shows a lot about the maturity of the Mac community and the developers in the Mac community. Understanding that, like, if you take all of these people who are buying on quality and design rather than price, there's also a group of people who will buy on quality and design in the apps that they use every day. But they're not going to suffer this bloatware just because that's what the people, their friends on Windows, use.
Yeah. Speaking of Pixelmator, have you guys been following the Mac heist saga? Do we do Mac heist here?
I was really surprised.
It's a good bundle.
It's a fantastic bundle. But then I'm saying, my God, this is like because the, you know, ethically, I needed to buy a copy of Snaps Pro because obviously they'll send me a free copy, you know, to write about. But this is something that I actually use professionally, so I need to buy a copy. And so that's been on my to do list for a long time. Then I find that I can buy Snaps Pro. Plus, like two or three other apps I really, really want to have, plus three or four others that I haven't used before, but are also great apps for like less than, almost a little bit more than half the price of what it would cost me to buy Snaps Pro.
Yeah, Pixelmator's on there. And now, you know, there was a lot of controversy. It has been a lot of controversy over these bundles.
Right, exactly. The surprising part was that I was telling people, I was in a cab with two developers on my way to dinner, and I mentioned, wow, this is so cool, and on top of everything else, they're donating a certain percentage to charity. This is really, really nice. And this, well, God, you can't be nice to those people. I don't want to pass along. I'm sure they didn't feel as though they're speaking on the record, so I won't pass along what they said specifically. But it left me with another item on my to-do list, which is to follow up on Mac Heist to see why these two people seem to have such a negative reaction to the idea of what they were doing.
I'm kind of following this. It's interesting. This is another great use for Twitter, is kind of following along and kind of eavesdropping on your friend's conversation.
It's like the live version of Wikipedia almost, isn't it?
It is. You know, it's true. And it's just about as credible. You kind of got to wait. What's the preponderance?
I trust that guy's icon. I believe him.
Look at him. He's a Mac SE with horns. But I mean, I don't know. And again, I don't know. I have not spent a lot of time with this. But I think part of the frustration I'm hearing is people saying, well, you know, there's things in here like these are versions that you can't upgrade. In some cases, they're sort of, you know, I don't know what the phrase for that would be, but
they're not necessarily full versions. The developers, I guess, because they get such a small amount of money, they want
to make money on the upgrades,
right? Often don't give you one of those versions that you can always upgrade for free. So you might only get this current version, that kind of thing. But even then, I think it's a pretty good deal. I'm conflicted. Gruber is the one who first said, "Hey, this is a ripoff for the developers." But I got to point out, the developers participate.
Right, exactly. It's not like they're just downloading stuff they found on the internet and then let the chips fall where they may. They read a contract, they sign a contract.
I think the first time around you could legitimately point out, look, they had no idea how much money was going to be involved. I mean, it's millions of dollars for each bundle. And so maybe they made a bad deal. But this is the second time around now, guys.
It would be worth having a couple of folks on either side. It might be interesting to speak
I'll
to them.
I tell you, I'm at this point, it's $49. By the way, one more day as we record this, you have till Wednesday the 23rd to do this. They just threw in Vector Designer, which by itself is $70.
Yeah.
Pixelmator's in there. That's $59. CSS Edit, we've talked about before from Mac Rabbit. OnePassword, which you were singing the praises of Merlin, and I have. There's, you know, Cha-Ching, we've talked about. We've talked with them. In fact, we should get the Cha-Ching guys on and say, why are you participating in this? What do you get out of it?
I mean, obviously, there's a certain element of getting exposure out of it. But it's funny, I just Twittered something not long ago about the value in your life of trying to rid yourself of all of your clients who buy on price and how much better your life gets. I think one problem is that with that exposure, you bring in a lot of people who are buying on price. And if you're somebody like a, I don't know, like a Buzz Anderson, like who has this insanely great application that he's out there selling for, like, I think his iPod program is like $8, you know, and then you have the support that goes along with that. Again, I don't know. I mean, there's two sides to every story, but it's definitely, I don't know. I really wonder. I wonder what the postscript is on this for the developers. I would love to hear their postmortem.
And you know, I have to say, I've purchased, and I usually do purchase, almost always purchase shareware. I really love the Mac shareware community, and they deserve the money. And so I've purchased a lot of these programs already. And even so, it seems like, boy, you know, if Pixelmator, I'll give
in
you
a way, it's I was going to say, in a way, it's a little bit like, you know, there's this wonderful story, I want to say, in The Atlantic a few years ago about how Walmart deals with its suppliers. Right. And I don't mean to say Mac Heist is the same.
But, I mean, yeah, they have no leverage with these guys. They're not.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're able to go in and make Levi's come up with an entire line of clothing just for Walmart. They're able to, Vlasic, a company that spent 30 years trying to build a brand around getting people to buy on quality, forces them to put out a 5-gallon barrel of pickles for $3 or whatever. Right. So, I mean, there's definitely market forces here. I think it's a very lively discussion, and it would be definitely be interesting to hear both sides. You know?
But there's also, I should say that one of the people who was in the cab with me is actually up on iChat, and I've just pinged him to see if he'd be
willing
to come on.
He's
replied that he's on the phone standby, so that could be 3 minutes, it could be 30. We'll see. We'll leave that as the lead that gets people to keep listening to the podcast.
I'll tell you what, Andy, I'm going to send you the phone number that he can call in to join us at any time, and you could send that to him. I'll send that to you in chat right now, and that way, if he wants to join us, he can. And if he wants to be anonymous, he can. Although I'd prefer it, obviously, if he'd say who he is. But, yeah, I'd love to hear what's wrong with this and why I shouldn't go plunk down my money.
I see who that is. I'd like to hear what that person has to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But while we're waiting for that, there's something that's kind of not unpleasant, but sometimes uncomfortable that we have to really acknowledge and Merlin, that's a great analogy you made bringing up Walmart. We don't like Walmart. We think that they... we often think that they do terrible things, especially for the labor situation in this country. But you can't deny that there are a great many people for whom saving $3 on a pack of tube socks is a really big and important deal. For the same reason, there are a whole bunch of people that would not be able to use apps of this caliber if not for the fact that companies like Mac Heist are making them available in these really, really affordable packages. So while I really, really want every developer to be able to put, you know, 3 kids through college based just on the fees that they're getting through their self-published software, I can't bring myself to say that unless Mac Heist is being deliberately deceptive and unethical in how they pay out to their developers, I can't bring myself to tell people not to buy this package, because it's just, if everything's above board, it's just a terrific deal. Sometimes you have to take the side. Sometimes you have to look at a situation from the user's point of view, as opposed to from the big picture point of view. And like I said, this is a fantastic deal for the users.
Well, we'll wait until we hear from our developer. It's the developer who decided not to participate, by the way. And, I presume. And, you know, yes. I guess what we would like to do is ask a developer who did participate why and how much they hope to get out of this. I don't think you do it to make money.
I think you do it to add seats to your user base. Then hopefully, you know, make yourself so invaluable that, you know, that they won't think about having it being out to you.
Right. Both of you guys had some stories you wanted to bring up. Let's start with you, Merlin. I'm looking at your blog post.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that?
My crazy hand waving? I don't know. You know, I blame I blame Andy. You got me thinking about a lot of really squirrely stuff after you, I don't know, you put some kind of Vulcan mind meld on me a few weeks ago. And now you've got me thinking about stuff. I had a post the other day. This is less in the service of pimping that than to just say, I think there's an interesting thing going on here. And I feel like if you look at what happened at Macworld and you look at kind of where the market is right now, and you look at several different factors, I keep coming back to this idea that I wonder what in the heck is going to happen next with .Mac. And I wonder about it for a couple of reasons, and I guess I wanted to hear what you guys think about it. The first thing that's interesting about it is I think anybody who uses .Mac and struggles with .Mac kind of wonders, to be candid, what the hell is up, like why it's not getting sort of fixed. And why it's still kind of crummy. Mm-hmm. And I guess I have to say
I use .Mac.
Well, just for example, how do you do with iDisk? How does iDisk work for you?
I set up a 10 gigabyte iDisk local that is automatically synced, and I use that to store critical documents or programs that I want to install.
You don't get sync problems with that.
No, it works reliably for me.
Well, this will be my version of missing sync, I guess, because I basically have to reset mine pretty much every day or two to make it work. Anyway, what I want to get at, and we might want to talk about this after we talk to our developer friend, but I'm just really interested in what the future, if they were to really trick out .Mac, what that looks like. And could there, in fact, be a world, as we see stuff like particularly the MacBook Air and the iPhone coming out, what does a world look like in which Apple themselves start being the repository for more of the media in your life, possibly even living in a cloud.
So you're saying that one of the things you might want to use .Mac with is the Air, and use it as your kind of hard drive.
Just for the sake of argument, what if something like, let's call it your home directory, lives on .Mac, right? What if, you know, Tilda Leo lives on .Mac, and you're basically, that is a master copy, parts of which end up getting synced as needed with all your different devices, your Mac Pro, your MacBook Air, your iPhone, your iPod Shuffle.
I use it to some degree that way already. I keep
you got my, the preferences, preference settings. I think those preference, the syncing preferences in Leopard.
Isn't that
right
interesting?
Now, I think that is the thin end of the wedge.
And the keychain. When I, for instance, I'm getting a new MacBook, it will be the simplest thing in the world to get that MacBook doing most of what I want. I use Yojimbo to hold all my serial numbers. That automatically syncs over .Mac.
And Migration Assistant. Think about how Migration Assistant works, where it actually remembers. I mean, I don't know if you've had the same good luck I've had, but when I use Migration Assistant, windows that I had open in a certain location are open after that.
You know, I'm kind of with Andy on this one. When I get a new computer, I use that as an opportunity to say, you know, you've got to reapply, folks. It's like when a new president comes along and the entire cabinet resigns. I think that I probably will not use Migration Assistant because I don't want to copy over any problems, but I will use .Mac to give me all the serial numbers, all the fonts. I keep a fonts folder on .Mac for all my unusual fonts that I install, many of which are your comic book fonts, Andy, by the way, and all the kind of things that are standard, like preferences, like keychain. I use .Mac to sync, and then I'll put the app, move the applications over that I want, or reinstall the applications that I want.
Do you remember, for example, do you remember your frustration with, I think it was, I don't know, a year or so ago, and you had that frustration with deregistering one of your Macs on iTunes,
yes.
Like a Mac you didn't have anymore?
Yeah.
I guess I just wonder, I know this is the squirreliest part of it, I understand. Like, I realize that the studios would freak if .Mac ever officially was hosting files, media files for you. But just think about that. Just think about if all your stuff is up in the cloud, look at the direction of things like smart folders. Think about Time Machine. What is Time Machine doing, basically? Time Machine is saying, look, I'm going to take care of all this for you. You don't need to worry about where it goes. I'm going to take care of this now, especially with Time Capsule.
Yeah.
And I just feel like these all kind of hint at this direction. The truly disruptive thing that they could do right now is not to make smaller laptops or not to make bigger iPhones.
Make a
but
better
to basically
Mac.
Become your one-stop shop for your entire electronic world.
Well, in a way, that's where they're going with iTunes. That's where they're going with Apple TV. I think that makes perfect sense. I guess the real question is why they haven't done it sooner with .Mac.
What do you think, Andy? Does that make any sense? Is that crazy talk?
.Mac definitely is the great unexploited resource at Apple. And I also think the great unexploited resource of users. There's just so much potential there. I've always thought that .Mac could work as the ultimate glue that finally makes your physical location and the actual computer sitting behind completely irrelevant.
Maybe it's just harder to do than we realize. I mean, look, they're trying with Back to My Mac and things like that.
Well, it's not, I mean, it's not all that hard. I mean, I'm already doing stuff just with Automator Actions that exploits .Mac in ways that really should be a menu item in the Finder. It should be a lot easier to simply
You can do this stuff right now with Unison. Or you can do this stuff with especially Unison, but
what's
even
Unison?
Rsync.
Unison is a
syncing program that'll also run diffs on text.
Ah.
And so basically, Unison's insane. It's not to be confused with Panic.com's Unison, but Unison is my syncing tool of choice.
And you can point it at a Unix tool that's imported.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's Panic. Panic makes it. No. Okay. I see. That's what I'm not.
But basically,
confused.
SSH into your server where it lives and say basically run diffs between these two like home directories. And, you know, obviously the first one takes a while, but after that, that's what I'm getting at though.
That's great.
Like with any of this stuff with Mosey, with Time Machine, with any of that stuff, once you get over the hump with that first sync, it's really trivial to keep differences.
Cause you're just syncing changes.
Exactly. And you add into the mix the ability to say like, oh, you know, for wherever I am in my motel, I want to go plug in and give me a fresh mix on my shuffle. And I add to that the ability of like, you no longer have these issues of what happens when you lose a computer with all your stuff on it. You get a super strong password and throw it on this in the cloud repository. And God, and then imagine them partnering with Google and using Google's applications as the online tool for running all that stuff. And all of a sudden, Microsoft has a really serious competitor on their hands. Just tossing it out.
No, yeah. I agree with you. I agree.
I'm not sure if Apple wants to lead the platform in that sort of a direction, but because their MO has always been real tactile like features that when somebody sits down behind a Macintosh, they appreciate that there's this thing they can do on this Macintosh that they can't do on other machines. And when I think about that, I think about things like, you know, you start up a, if you have more than one Macintosh and you launch Mail for the first time, the first thing you did when you set up, when you install the OS, was tell it what your .mac address is, and magically Mail has configured itself because it knows what all your email addresses are. It knows what all your iChat pals are. It knows what all your address book stuff are. Right now, we can do it in the sense of it'll just simply resync information down from .mac. But what I'm getting at is the ability to simply drop by any single Macintosh anywhere in the world, and just by virtue of the fact that it knows that I have this .mac account, it can instantly transform any Mac I'm sitting behind into my home Mac.
Exactly.
You know, yeah, and they have that capability. I mean, they've been doing that for years with school systems. So, I mean, that capability is already there with Mac Server.
Yeah. I think the one thing that's going to be kind of necessary is to either beef up the encryption that's on that volume, or at least make it more apparent how secure that system is. It's always been, I believe that the truth of the matter is that it is a simple case of you have that one password, and if someone guesses that password, you're kind of hosed.
Well, it's as strong as Apache, right? I mean, it's just HTAccess, right?
It's as strong as that. It's still, there's always that hard limit as to what I'm willing to put up on my .Mac.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm also, at this point, I'm getting more and more concerned that I have one Apple ID password, and if someone knows what it is, they can get at all the files on my .Mac. They can purchase $100 worth of stuff on the iTunes store, on the Apple store. I would like to see different levels of password security. If that were to happen, I would probably be exploiting .Mac a lot more. As it is, I have created the de rigueur automator action that says, look, if I've touched this file in the past two days, please upload it to .Mac so that I can get it if things go badly for
so
me.
So you do that in lieu of the .Mac local drive setup.
How do you mean?
Well, you can create an iDisk that's local. And then if you have that iDisk, you have automatic sync. That's what I've been doing.
Yeah, that's what I do.
It takes 10 gigs on your hard drive, but...
Sorry, but that's what I meant. I have that, plus I have a CD sized secure disk image that I move back and forth. It's not so much that it's a better solution, that it's a solution that I understand. I understand that this is encrypted with really great protection. I've got a really great 24 character password on it, and even if someone does have my .Mac password and they download this disk image,
at least that's
unless they have access to $1 trillion budget in the United States Army, they're probably not going to be able to break it.
So I think we're using .Mac. I think we're getting our value out of .Mac. I think anybody who has more than one Mac, just for the syncing and the iDisk alone, I think .Mac is worth the $80 or $90 you might
pay. Seems so interesting, though. They put so much care and sense of finish into what they do. And it sounds, Leo, it sounds like you're not having the same problems I am, but I can tell you from just the responses I get on Twitter and from my blog that there's a lot of pain out there.
Syncing is always a mess. Syncing is always a mess. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I've been lucky. But, you know, anytime you sync, you always have issues. Yeah. What I do regularly is I make copies of my address book, my iCal, you know, local backup copies. And I do reset maybe, you know, monthly. I'll have to do a reset because something got out of sync. But as long as you have those local copies, the reset seems to work pretty well. I mean, I haven't lost any data. Let's put it that way. Anyway, that's good. So a call for Apple
That's a prediction. Let's put that one down. Let's put that down. That's going to be my squirrely prediction, is that eventually the contents of your Mac will live on .Mac. I want that on the record.
You know, you need better broadband to do it, frankly. Let's face it.
For syncing? Yeah. You think including sync just for syncing?
Well, not the diff-based syncing you're talking about. But when you're talking about your home directory, you could go to any Mac, log in, and your home directory appears there. That's 10 or more gigabytes, probably more, that has to kind of be available to you in almost real time. You need a high speed connection.
I don't think you'd be running it off that server, but I mean, running diffs on that, if you're using Unison, you can see like running diffs on stuff like that is not.
I thought you wanted to be able to use any Mac.
No, see, that's the beauty of it. So imagine that becomes the master copy that lives on .Mac, and then the slaves are on all of your different Macs.
Well,
so when you log in, you automatically in the background, every night or whatever.
I misunderstood. I thought you wanted this capability, which, again, Apple Server does offer, OS X Server does offer,
sure.
to log into any Mac, and boom, it's your Mac.
I don't want that one in my production kit. No, I'm going to take that out of the production.
I want that. I like that. Then you can use anybody's MacBook Air, and all of a sudden,
doesn't the MacBook Air with a fresh account suddenly start making a lot more sense? Because think about what you just described, Leo. You log into somebody's machine, they make a new account, right? You go in, you make a password, you identify what your .Mac information is,
and it's all
you go
there.
Out to lunch, and when you come back, everything at like Tilda Library that's super important to you, or everything at Tilda has been like synced.
10 gigs isn't everything I've got. It's not all my photos, obviously. It's not my iTunes library, but it's enough. That everything I really need is there. And that's how I use it.
Every time I buy a new PowerBook, I copy my documents folder from the old one to the new one. I've done this from Lilith number one, my PowerBook 100, all the way to the very latest one. And even so, we're talking about less than 6 gigabytes worth of document data. Again, not pictures, not music, but in terms of document data. Yeah. The stuff that I would really, really, really be hitting the vodka if I ever lost it for good.
if I got rid of downloads, iTunes, meaning movies, videos, and if I got rid of that and I got rid of photos, I got 34 gigs.
You know what could kill you?
If
is Keynote. Those, Keynote can kill you. One Keynote speech can be a gigabyte.
Oh, because it stores
all the media in there.
It's a folder. Yeah.
And I'd love to save that, but I don't save the keynotes for that reason. I mean, wouldn't it be nice, Andy, if you had put all your presentations on your iDisk?
What about for the Leo Laporte Library? They're going to have at Yale someday. What?
I'm sending Yale. No, I send Yale regular DVDs with the latest, so they have everything.
Yes, it's my belief that really 10 megabytes is all the hard drive that anyone could ever require.
Yeah,
hey, Mr. Laporte, next time, please put it on a DVD RW so that we can reuse the DVD.
Thank you. We have a coffee table already. Please, yeah. So, Andy, you had some things you wanted to talk about. When we started this before we went on air, I said, this is going to be the silliest Mac Break week ever because we have nothing to talk about. But apparently,
that's always a bad boast to make, because if you were looking for the silliest Mac Break we've ever done, that's an awfully high bar for us. And plus, we're just coming back from a week of travel. We just don't have enough.
Hey, you don't want to dare us with that.
Let me see if we can get Scott Bourne on there. No, I saw Scott Bourne on briefly, and now he's gone again. But hey, did have some things you wanted to talk about, guys. I mean, I'm not.
Yeah. I mean, there's now someone a reader emailed me just today with an observation about the MacBook Air, saying that he sees it not so much as a MacBook, so much as a transitional device towards that big, wonderful iPhone tablet and these other cool things that might be in the offing in the future. And my reply was a wonderfully practiced mix of humility, appreciation, and arrogance, by which I said, my reply was, I think you're totally and completely wrong, but you've given me a great idea. because as I'm sitting there in the keynote, I'm thinking, my God, they actually convinced Intel, which is like the company that manufactures clean water for the entire planet, and they decided, this H2O that you're making for us is kind of chunky. Could you make us a water molecule that's half as big? And Intel said, sure.
Is it a special chip on there? Is it something special?
Well, no, it's the exact same chip, only a package that's much, much, much smaller.
Oh, so they did make it a special dip for it.
Right. And so what it made, and so I was wondering, well, geez, that's a really big deal for them to do that, especially for a product that's going to be, it's a good product, but it's sort of iffy. I mean, it has the potential of being one of those things that does okay for about a year and then sort of trickles out. Right. What this email made me think is that, well, what if Apple told Intel that, look, we can't tell you what we're planning, but we're going to need a whole bunch of really small versions of this chip. We need to build a whole bunch of machines that have the power of a MacBook, but need to be fit in tiny, tiny, tiny little packages, like tablets, like half tablets, like all these other small packages. When you think about all the things that we've been fantasizing about that might be coming out in 2008, 2009, 2010, again, these entirely new classes of multi-touch devices, and you start thinking about, well, what would be required in order to pull that off? One of them would be smaller, lower heat, lower package CPUs.
So your conspiracy theory is the reason Intel went along with this is just the first of a whole new product line from Apple.
I think that so much of what's required when you're trying to speculate about these things is not only the aforementioned fifth of vodka, but also trying to realize that you can't just sit down in front of a whiteboard and build the entire world that you need in order to make this product happen. You have to do things in increments. And one of them is, once again, if you need a small microprocessor that has the power of a desktop processor, you can't just simply special order that when the time comes. You need to build the infrastructure so that these are rolling off the assembly lines, so this becomes a stock product when the time comes. Similarly, you cannot start writing a brand new development system for this unseen device. You can't expect to get real production on that kind of a software, especially if you're trying to teach an entire community of developers to start all over again. You need to lay the groundwork for that quickly. And that's, like I've said before, that's what I see the iPhone software development kit coming in.
Merlin, so, you may get your 10 or 12-inch MacBook just with more of an iPhone feel to it.
I wouldn't mind that so much.
No. I think I mentioned this last week, but I don't know if anybody's got any further information. The touch capabilities of that touchpad, is that a hardware feature or something that could be extended to other computers in software?
My understanding is that it is a hardware feature, that you can't simply do a firmware update and suddenly my G4 PowerBook can handle multi-touch.
Now, I have to say that gives us, I think, 90% of what I would like with it. I mean, you don't need to have the touch screen if I could do it on the pad. Do you agree?
Yeah. I think the whole touch screen thing is, I don't know. I wouldn't
fingerprinty.
I wouldn't be really surprised if I saw it. But at the same time, that's, I don't know. Because then that also, then you knowing how Mac developers are and how just the whole Apple culture is, that's a sea change in how you use an application. I mean, you know, to just put something onto a touchscreen and think you're going to use it in that same way. And I'll just think about the pattern that causes you to use. If you're like me and you got this big ass Dell monitor sitting in front of you, right, and you use your desk in a certain way, that really, unless they really do get into the whole syncable, you know, put your iMac into the slot thing, I don't know. I don't see it. I really don't see it.
Well, also, it has to be implemented. I mean, as far as I could tell, it was only iPhoto that could see these gestures, right?
I did ask those specific questions. Unfortunately, there was a bunch of there were a bunch of questions I asked during my briefing, and this isn't a group briefing. This is like me and one guy. That the answer was, we're not prepared to talk about that, or let me get back to you on that. One of them was that there is the question about exactly how these multi-touch gestures are being implemented. It is not a system by which magically Microsoft Word or whatever app you're using right now will understand these gestures. It's not like there's something that translates immediately. He told me that there is an OS level Mojo, and then there is an API level Mojo.
But you have to write the apps to the API.
I don't know. Exactly. Like, do you remember, like, when, I mean, there's all those little kind of kernel extension things out there that that'll let you turn your regular old touchpad into, like, the scrolly kind and stuff like that. You think it would really take different hardware in order to do that?
There's a difference between doing something and doing something to Apple standards. There are a whole bunch of different third-party utilities for adding gesture-like interfaces, especially after the iPhone came out. But a lot of them work kind of squirrely, especially when you talk about, again, we're all nerds. You know, the things that we have, the amount of condiments, emollients, and other things we have on our fingers as we're eating our lunch and trying to get a little work done, will absolutely kneecap any software-based solution for multi-touch gestures. And when you're considering that when you're entering commands by gesture, it misinterpreting a double swipe for a triple swipe can have really, really bad, really inconvenient consequences, shall we say. Yeah. So it's important for this thing to actually work.
Yeah, sure.
All right. I do think I like the notion that this could be a bigger product line and could include touch. I think we have a magic voice on the line with us right now. Hey, Rich, good to talk to you. Rich is the man behind Barebones Software, creators of course, Text Wrangler, BB Edit, Yojimbo, and Andy rode in a cab with you, Rich.
Yes.
Hey, Rich.
Hi.
That's Merlin Mann.
Hi, Merlin. Hi, Leo. Hi, Andy.
Mr. Siegel. So, I've been looking at the Mac Heist bundle thinking this is great. I remember the controversy last time, and I remember, in fact, John Gruber saying, you know, these guys are making millions and sharing very little with the developers. Why would anybody do this? hey, it's the second time around. Surely anybody doing it is going in with open eyes. And I have to say, from the point of view of a consumer, this bundle of what, you know, almost a dozen programs for $49 look 14 for $49 looks pretty good. So what do you think as a developer?
Well, as a developer, I would not participate in something like this. I'll tell you why. The first is that, yes, granted, it's a terrific deal for consumers. I think it's really hard and difficult, really, really difficult to argue with the appeal of you know, buying a whole bunch of really great software at a just simply amazing price if you compare against the individual purchase prices. But as a developer, I see a few problems here. One of them, and perhaps the one that really hits close to home for me because I'm still involved in a lot of the tech support for our product, is that if you acquire, you know, 10,000 brand new customers as the result of something like this, you're then on the hook to support each and every one of them that happens to call in for support. And part of the purchase price of any piece of software, part of the magic, if you will, of pricing any piece of software is taking this sort of thing into account. Offering tech support is part of the cost of doing business. And so if you don't factor that into the price of your software, you're going to find yourself taking a very long walk off a very short pier, business speaking. So the moment a customer of a bundle calls in for support, you've lost anything you've made on that sale, and actually a whole lot more. Beyond that, there are a couple of other considerations, really mostly related to value. The products that participate in these bundles are basically permanently devalued because now an expectation has been created that that the product should always be this cheap.
Right.
Hey, you know, I got it as part of a $50 bundle, so how much could it really be worth?
Right. That's a good point.
And that makes it very difficult to make a real offering later on. And I think that effect tends to bleed over into the rest of the marketplace, and I think it ends up affecting developers who don't participate in these sorts of things as well, which is a little bit counterintuitive, but I think nonetheless accurate. We've seen over the past couple of years a real change in the way people look at the prices of their software, and they seem to have an expectation of, you know, well, I could get this for effectively $2.50. Why should I pay $30, $40, $50, however many dollars for it?
So why would a developer participate in something like this?
I think there are some arguments that sound good on the surface but don't hold up to scrutiny. A couple of them that I've heard are that it builds brand awareness and generates buzz, and that is true to a degree, but I have to wonder at what cost the buzz comes, and especially when, you know, certain things happen, and I'll get into that later maybe, if, you know, things happen and all of a sudden you get associated with an effort which perhaps isn't universally respected.
Mm.
And the next thing happens is you've been touched by that and you can't quite recover. Another argument I've heard is that, hey, you know, we'll sell an old unsupported version and we'll make back the money in upgrade revenue.
Right.
And I don't buy into that one either, because what happens is you'll find at the end of the day that the crossover rate for upgrades is really pretty low, and part of it has to do with the fact that customers who are willing to pay that little for your software in the first place are going to think extra carefully about spending 5 or 10 times that amount of money for an upgrade, because right. That's kind of what it works out to. If they
right.
If the effective cost of your product was $2 and you asked $20 for an upgrade,
right.
They're going to say, "Well, wait a minute." You know, those are really the two big ones that I've heard a lot of.
Now, see, I bought Yojimbo, I bought BB Edit. I spend money. I bought half of these programs already. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
I believe in supporting the shareware community. Should I avoid a bundle like this because it's bad for the community?
I don't feel that I'm in a place where I can tell anybody what to do in this context. All I can really ask is that you think about the implications and decide what is best for you.
Yeah.
If the budgeting is such that this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to you and the other considerations aren't important, then go for it. Personally, I would rather look at a piece of software in that bundle and say, okay, I want that piece of software, and I'm going to make sure that I support the developer in the fullest possible fashion, which means, in this case, making sure they get as much of my money as possible.
Of course, the developer in this case is obviously signed up. I mean, it's not like they're being, you know, fooled into doing this, I don't think.
No, certainly, and that's an argument that I've heard as well, is that, you know, well, the developer's going into this with open eyes, and nobody's holding a gun to their head, nobody's right. lying to them, et cetera, et cetera. And I accept that statement as fact, but I also think that in some cases, the developers are choosing to ignore the larger considerations, and in other cases, the developers have made the larger considerations and decided that they're not important. And I think that either way, it's a legitimate decision. Whether or not I agree with it is obviously a different matter.
It sounds to me, I'm not putting words in your mouth, I'm just going for my own take, that the way that I personally would justify this package is that it gives a user a way to legitimately acquire a whole bunch of really good software, and hopefully later, I'm sure this wouldn't actually be communicated, but from my point of view, if there's specific software in these packages that I absolutely adore and rely on day in and day out, that I might be motivated to then make sure that I put some more, I buy another copy of this either through upgrade or at some later point directly through the manufacturer, so that the loyalty that they bought by giving me such a deal on this version gets paid off down the line with better terms.
I think that's a valid argument, Andy, but I also think that in the larger sense, except for people like you and I who really do think that through, it rarely actually happens.
Okay.
And that it doesn't happen enough to offset the losses from people who simply ignore the other products in the bundle that aren't important to them, or simply take advantage of having gotten a great price on multiple pieces of software.
Yeah. I also like to go back to something that you said earlier about how if your software product has been touched by a Mac heist, in some way Mac heist's fingerprints will stick to you, and that might not be something that you like. How would you equate that? Is it sort of like when you know, no matter how good that your hair care product is, once it's being hawked at an infomercial with David Hasselhoff, suddenly it seems like it's a much cheaper and tawdrier thing than it was before? Or is it part of just the developer community understanding the sort of terms that you had to accept in order to sell your software that way, that gives you sort of a little piece of rat hair on you?
I think that both sides of that equation couldn't have possibly been expressed any better, Andy. And I think that both of them to some degree are true. I know that in the developer community, you know, although individual developers are contractually forbidden to make the terms of their deals public, there's been a certain amount of you know, sub rosa discussion about the whole thing. And I wouldn't say that developers resent other developers for having participated in Mac Heist, but it's the sort of thing that people notice in the community and they don't really forget. And I think that sort of addresses the second part of your commentary. You know, I am aware of some of the developers and products who've participated in the current Mac heist and the previous ones, and I wouldn't say that I respect them any less. I think the decision still for them to do so still sort of confounds me. But again, they made that decision, and they're all grown ups, and just the way they choose to go. And it's not for me to say otherwise. As for the first part, the sort of infomercial David Hasselhoff angle, I have to say, yeah, To me, that's there's very much a lie down with dogs, get up with fleas thing going on there. The thing that's got this frontmost in my mind is that just before the announcement of the latest Mac heist, this was toward the end of November of 07, there was a situation in which some fairly well-known bloggers and news outlets, their sites were defaced by this anonymous hacker who went under the handle Malcor. To make a long story short, it turned out that Malcor wasn't real. The defacements were real, but they were done with the knowledge and consent of the bloggers and the news outlets involved.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, that was pretty much my reaction.
To get publicity?
To get publicity.
Jeez.
And at first they didn't cop. I mean, at first some of them right out said, "I've been hacked." Ugh. Now, if you stop at that first step and think for a moment, let's say you're a blogger and you're hosted by Media Temple or Expression Engine or another hosting service whose business runs on secure hosting of blog and news sites. Well, if you're the provider of that hosting service, all kinds of alarm bells start going off. Your customers start calling in panicked. Oh my God, somebody got defaced. What's going to happen to me? And that happened in a couple of cases. And finally, sort of some rumors started going around that it was Mac Heist that was behind the fake defaces, that it was Mac Heist that was behind the hoax. And sure enough, that was the case. And, you know, a couple of the bloggers said, "Yeah, we're sorry, we got caught. It was a bad decision."
What was the percentage in it for the bloggers and for Mac Heist? I don't understand even what the point was.
For the bloggers, it's hard to say. Well, no, scratch that. In terms of finance, it's impossible for me to say. I don't know if anybody took any
money.
Maybe
they were paid to do it. All right.
There's, you could certainly question that. I really do not know, and I don't want to speculate.
Right.
Obviously, what happens is it generates buzz. It generates buzz for the websites involved. It generates buzz for Mac Heist.
Well, there's if nothing, these Mac Heist guys are good at marketing. If nothing else.
Yes.
I mean, there's no question about that. They've got us talking about them.
Indeed. And you know, what we're really talking about right now is what is, if you will forgive me for saying it so bluntly, frankly, a juvenile stunt.
Right.
This sort of thing drives reputable marketing and PR people absolutely up a tree.
Oh, yeah. Well, get ready because there's going to be a lot more of it. I mean, I think that's kind of the nature of the beast now. And it's the same thing. Journalists sometimes are driven crazy by the ethics of bloggers and podcasters.
So, hey, Rich, if you've been around this business for a while now, this is Merlin, and if a young developer came to you and was looking at an opportunity to participate in a bundle, what kind of advice would you give them? What kind of terms would you want to look for? What would you say? What kind of decision-making goes into deciding whether to do it at all?
I would say very carefully examine what you want to get out of it. And I would be predisposed to say simply don't do it. Hmm. If you're a young developer and you've got a startup and you've got a new product, the product is really going to fly or not on its own merit. If you try to undercut your core message with pricing, if you say, "Hey, look how cheap you can get this," the message you're sending is really bad. The message you're sending is, "I've got nothing really else to recommend my product with, so I'm going to recommend it on price."
Yeah, this is what it's worth.
Yeah, and so if you've got a hot new idea and you think it's the greatest thing that's since sliced bread, put it out there. Pick a price for it that you believe the market will bear and that meets the intersection of what the market will bear and what can sustain you and your business, and go for it. I think that is really the best long-term sustainable way to get a product out there and successful.
Rich, I really want to thank you for joining us. I think you stated this so eloquently and so perfectly. I don't think there's any question now in my mind about Mac Heist and whether I want to participate. But I leave it to our listeners who are astute. And Rich, you, as the grand old men of Mac developers, we're really glad we could get you on Mac Break Weekly.
Well, thank you, Leo, and thank the rest of you guys and the listeners for giving me the time to answer these questions and express my views.
Barebones.com. It's the place to get BB Edit. Yojimbo. I just talked about how I used Yojimbo all the time. And Text Wrangler. Thank you so much, Rich.
Thank you, Leo.
So I'm glad we could thank you for setting that up too, Andy, because I think that was he said it pretty clearly.
Yeah, if I try to remember exactly how he said it, I probably would have screwed it up. And plus, it's his words. He has the right to say it, not me.
And Rich is so respected in the Mac community. I mean, he's been around from the beginning, for one thing.
He's in the developer community. He's the man with the pointy hat. You never argue with a man wearing a pointy hat, son.
Yep.
The one shirt from the 1990s that I have not allowed my wife to throw out. It went from having actual yellowed pits to actually like kind of forming some kind of a primordial crust.
Oh my God!
Is my original 1996 BB Edit. It doesn't suck T-shirt, which I got for putting a badge on my website in about 1996. Now, there's some marketing for you. Put up a badge, you get a T-shirt. It's pretty transparent.
I think Apple still uses BB Edit to do their website, as a matter of fact.
Oh, God, I know so many people who use BB Edit.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I go to NASA and I see, you know the guy who does BB Edit? Tell him that I use the grep feature.
It is. It's a great grep.
I still think it would be really valuable to hear somebody on the other side of that who has a different take, but this stuff is so complicated and it's really hard. I don't think I bought Mac Heist. There was a bundle I bought not long ago. It might have been Mac
Heist.
There was
another one. They did it before Mac Heist.
One password in it. Yeah. Was that Mac Heist?
Mac Heist has done it twice now, but there was another one before Mac Heist, and I can't remember for the life of me.
Anyway, I bought one of these not long ago, but it's really hard to know this stuff, and I think it's really valuable. If you're somebody who really wants to see everybody get a fair shake, I think it's worth hearing these different points of view.
I know Philip Ryu. Philip, you're welcome to come on and talk about it if you want. He's the guy behind Mac Heist and behind that Blogger scam.
I'd love to hear his response in particular to that. I had not heard that.
Yeah,
so
I hadn't either. I'm actually kind of shocked at that. And some would say, and I'm sure Philip will, hey, it's a new world and this is guerrilla marketing. I also would love to hear from any developer who has been part of Mac Heist and what their experience has been. Has it been good for you? Would you do it again?
What's the best way for people to...
Just email leo@leoville.com and next Mac Break Weekly is next Tuesday and we'll put you on. We'll give you a chance to speak out. And I'm sure we will hear from them, all of them. And maybe we'll get Gruber on too, because he was the guy who was, I think, started the original criticism.
He did a really extensive post with some pretty, if memory serves, correct me on this if I'm wrong, but he did a post that
numbers.
Was really deep on numbers.
Yeah, he had numbers. And... you're not allowed to talk about the numbers, so I don't know. I'm trying to remember what the original, I do believe there was a bundle before. They didn't come up with the bundle originally, but it might have been the same group of guys. I'm not sure. Anyway, I'm glad we could talk about that. Do you guys have anything else you want to raise before we get to our picks of the week?
No, I think that much like Steve Jobs, we managed to talk a whole lot about air today.
You know what? Good
well
show.
Done. Well done,
show.
Us.
Some great topics. I'm very happy, Andy. But before we do our picks, let's do our Audible pick.
Our Audible pick. I do, of course, have an Audible pick. This is I love those sort of books where if you read it too early in your life, you'll enjoy it, and if you read it too late in your life, you'll enjoy it. But if you are exposed to this book at exactly the right time in your life, it can materially change exactly all the choices that you make from that point onward. And for me, one of those books was Richard Feynman's, the Nobel Prize winning physicist, book of memoirs, Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman.
Mm-hmm.
Notes, the subtitled Notes of a Curious Character. And he had an entire, not only he was brilliant, but it's not so much that he knew all about this physics stuff, so much that he led his life with a spirit of adventure and wanting to try new things and wanting to have adventures that just about anyone can emulate. And my God, the adventures that he had. He was, his first big thing was he worked on the Manhattan Project, but he was a young physicist at that time. He was essentially the smart guy. He was essentially the middle manager and errand boy who knew all about the physics, so that if they sent him on an errand to check out a plant where they're refining uranium, he's the guy who would understand exactly what the instructions are and find out if they were going well or not. I will have to, anyone who's read his books, his memoirs, this is the first of two or three, I think, that he wrote, will be able to rattle off their favorite stories. It reminds me of one of my favorite stories. I will rattle it off, not
Please
nearly
do.
As well
Please do.
Yeah. as he did it himself. So like I said, he was like about 21, 22. I'm not even sure he had his doctorate in physics yet. But again, he was whereas, you know, Niels Bohr and all those other big, big, big shot physicists were the people who were at the blackboard figuring out how to engineer the atomic bomb. He was the guy that, you know, they could spare this guy to go out, you know, to the plant where they're refining the uranium. And so because he's the guy who's from Los Alamos sent this physicist to check on the plant, so they tended to treat him like a really big shot when he came to these places. And so at the plant, they were really, really proud of this brand new refinery that they were building to refine this uranium. And the whole point about this plant is that you can't allow too much of the stuff to accumulate in one place at one time, or else, boom, big explosion, Chernobyl. You can't have that happen. And so at the end of the tour, they already think he's a super genius. And this is how he describes it in the memoir, that he's not really all that smart, but he has an uncanny memory for remembering numbers. And so he was able to pull off tricks like saying, well, geez, back there when you're looking at vat A cistern B, B12, you're talking about this so-and-so. And they figured, well, geez, he can remember all these details like after only seeing it once. He must be a super duper genius. So they take him into this room where they've got all the blueprints for the brand new, wonderful new plant they're taking. And it's a huge, long table covered with stacks and stacks and stacks of blueprints. And they want to impress on him how carefully they've engineered this building to move all the product throughout the plant so that, you know, safety is paramount, that at no point can too much of the stuff build up in one place. They've got everything backed up with two different safety valves, so that if one valve, you know, were to let go, don't worry, there's another safety valve in its place. And so they're taking him through like the route that the stuff is going to be taking through the entire complex, and it goes up to this pipe, then goes into this building, then through this wall, and blah blah blah, lifting up blueprints, going from sheet to sheet to sheet. And what they don't know, and this is it's all written in the first person, but what I should have told them early on was that I have no idea how to read blueprints. And I'm getting more and more lost as this demonstration is going onward and onward and onward. But I know that I'm totally screwed here, because it would have been okay to say at the very beginning, I'm sorry, I don't understand blueprints. But at this point, they'd look at each other and say, well, why did you have us go for 20 minutes to explain things you didn't understand? So I came up. So I got this idea that there's this little symbol that I see. I think it's the symbol for a window that, you know, is all over the place. And if I figure that if I know what the symbol for window is, at least I'll be able to orient myself. I'll know like where the walls are, you know, where the external walls are. And so they're talking about, you know, the valve system. So I randomly put my finger down on one of these little window symbols and say, oh, what happens if this valve right here gets stuck? And expecting them to say, oh, no, I'm sorry, that must be a blurb on the blueprint. That's not a valve, that's a window. But instead, they tell me, well, sir, if this valve gets stuck and it goes all the way through, tracing the route, up the stack, down the stack, and then suddenly they look at each other with this expression of like stunned goldfish and say, oh my God, you're absolutely right, sir. Because just at random, he'd picked out the one valve that if it had failed, it would have blown up the entire plant.
But it was totally Chauncey Gardner, like he just... Yeah.
Exactly. And it's not that he, you know, he has a third grade education, just fakes his way through his entire career.
Oh, no.
But these are the sort of stories he tells. He tells a story about after the bomb, when he's helping out, you know, writing up all the papers and explaining how it works, that he had to learn how to be a safe cracker to get at certain documents, and adventures and being a professor in Brazil, the effects of winning the Nobel Prize, even moments like him suffering burnout after Los Alamos, when he was now just a regular professor at Cornell and he lost all of his joy for physics, and how he regained his joy. I read this book when I was 17 or 18. And once again, it really does give you the confidence at that age to realize that, you know, we're all freaks in certain areas and we're all think that we're good at some things, but we have to have humility in other things. And if you just leave yourself open to certain experiences and remind yourself that this is a world of joy and adventure, and you just have to appreciate and accept that in your life, it will be a template for a lot of great experiences in your life. I only wish that I think there's still a site where you can actually buy these stories read by Feynman himself.
Yeah, his voice was so great. I just loved it.
Exactly.
Voice.
I mean, it's this Brooklyn dead end kid voice that is one of the most important physicists of the 20th century. But this one is read by some guy named Raymond Todd, but it is unabridged. And on that basis, I can't imagine it being anything less than wonderful.
Well, and the really good news I'm very pleased to see is Audible has all of the Feynman lectures available. So you can get 6 easy pieces, 6 not so easy pieces, and then the individual lectures, I think, from the Red Book. So if you want to hear Feynman in his own voice, you've got to be a physics fanatic to listen to these, because they're serious physics. But after you read the fun, easygoing, light Feynman books, like The Pleasure of Finding Things Out, and of course your pick, Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, you can actually hear his voice on these other lectures. This must be something new, because I had looked before for the lectures, and I had them on cassette. I'm so glad that they're offering them now. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's just the greatest. 6 easy pieces, also 6 not so easy pieces, and then the, I think it's 20-something volumes of the Feynman lectures. Absolutely.
And
fantastic.
I've just checked out, and if you go to Feynman.com, I don't believe they have the CDs, but they have other information about Feynman, his later adventures. And if you haven't, in any group in which at least 3 people have at least 4 microprocessors on their bodies,
yeah.
Mention the word Richard Feynman and you will get, oh my God. Then you have this, then when he was on the Challenger shuttle chip disaster.
That's right. He was actually already dying of cancer at the time. And he chaired the Challenger investigative committee and figured out what happened.
Well, I won't give anything away, but that in itself is a great story. He's the guy who did the big demonstration that sort of shed the light on the thing. But then in the book, he explains, well, I didn't realize till later on that I was being manipulated by some guy.
Oh.
So it's great to know that even in the 60s, even when he is the legendary Richard Feynman, he still has that humility to realize that, oh, maybe I'm not as smart as I thought I was after all.
Fantastic. Feynman. This could be your free book. You know, we have a deal through audible.com. We continue with this deal. It's audible.com/MacBreak. You go to that website, sign up. You'll get a credit toward a free book. Pick a Feynman book, any Feynman book. You'll be happy. audible.com/MacBreak. 45,000 books. And, you know, every time I go back there, as I just did, and do a search, more and more stuff. They add thousands of books every week. And I'm really pleased to see the depth of the Feynman material they've got online here. This is real.
Yeah.
I now have a listening for years to come. There's quite a bit of stuff on here.
That's a big part of what I like about Audible, and that you get to rediscover all these books it's great for new stuff, of course, but it's great when there's this book that you read 8 or 9 years ago that you suddenly realize that, oh my God, this is available on Audible. Yeah. You buy it and you get to listen to it in the car, or listen to it on the airplane. You enjoy it without all that heavy lifting of turning pages. As geeks, we need to conserve energy whenever possible.
10 years of great books. Audible.com/MacBreak. We do thank them for their support. And now, Andy, unless you want to rest your voice a little bit, I'll ask you for your software pick or hardware pick.
Software pick, I'm sure there are at least 2. I've got a long list that I could use from Macworld last week, but I think that at least a couple of them are already, you know, in you or Merlin have already chambered it and have the hammer back and pressure on the trigger. Really, the place to be at Macworld Expo last year was the butt end of Apple. Behind the Apple booth was a whole bunch of little
Tiny Town.
I love Tiny Town.
You could for a small amount of money as a developer, you could buy 1 square meter of space.
Literally.
And that's where some of the most awesome stuff was.
I agree.
I'm going to choose one that I'm sure you're not going to, I hope you're not going to pick. It's a little app called Tubble, T-O-O-B-L-E.
T-O-O-B-L-E, okay.
And you can download, it's a free app. You can download it from Tubble.tv. It is the first YouTube download utility that I've liked enough to actually recommend.
Cool.
You do mesotonic C, Merlin. You go diatonic F.
No. This you'll always get our attention on this show if you talk about YouTube.
Yeah. Right? This is cool.
In both my books, I mentioned tools for downloading. You're not supposed to be able to download stuff off of YouTube. There are tricks to get around it, and I mentioned them. There are also utilities that purport to be able to do this, but either they do it in a very, very lame way, or YouTube changes a semicolon at some point, and the tool becomes worthless. This is a really great one-stop shopping utility that you launch the application. It does require that you download a little helper program. It's a freeware app called Parian that gives QuickTime the ability. We should have it anyway. It adds a whole bunch of different file formats to QuickTime. But once you do it, you get a one window browser that you can search for YouTube videos, click on any videos you like, just click on download. Whether it's one video or 100, it'll download all these videos, convert them into QuickTime, and then add them to your QuickTime library. Obviously, there's some loss in quality because you're taking a compressed thing and turning it into another compressed format. But it's quick. It actually works. Now that Google has locked down the API for YouTube, there's very little chance that this app will stop working. The coolest thing is that it's being done by a couple of Now, when I say kids, I'm talking about grown adults, grown adults who cannot buy beer yet, probably, or who can buy beer yet, but can't do so legally. And they're, of course, they have a business plan and everything. Tubal is absolutely free. It's not shareware or anything like that. Their plan is to do kind of like what the iSquint guys did, which is to give away the basic app for free. And then once they've developed fans, to roll out a better version alongside it that will cost money if people want to buy it. But there's nothing hacked down or limited about Tubal as is. I've been using it. I downloaded it for the first time Friday night, and I've been using it pretty much every day since. It really is quite slick.
Does it do Google Video?
It is just for YouTube, as far as I know. There is a box where you can enter a URL. I don't know. Let me try that right now. I'm going to go into Google Video.
Because that's always the thing is, the nice thing about Google Video, for what they allow much longer movies. So I was able to, just for educational purposes, pull down a copy of Horse Feathers.
Cool. Oh, great. Okay, Marx Brothers movie. All right.
I'm on videogoogle.com. I'm skipping past six different Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speeches to get the Bud Light Saucers commercial.
Oh, there you go.
That's a cute commercial.
It's just good you're not running for president, Andy. That's all.
I cannot tell you how many of these I have gone through. I think at least three of them have probably been features on here. Let's just look quickly. We've got Tube TV. We've got Tube Sock. We've got Tube Sock Loader. And the latest one I've used is called Video Box, which will basically, if I can just heist your feature here, Andy, you leave this app open, and anytime Safari can find an FLV on the page, it'll start queuing it. Over in this app. And then you go and say, okay, well, here's all the things I've queued. Give me this one, this one, this one, this one.
That's great.
And then it grabs them all. It's not grabbing them at a very large size. So, I mean, I think there's still room for somebody to dominate this.
My favorite tool outside of this, and by the way, it would seem as though it did not like the Google Video URL, just didn't do anything about that. But my generalized internet video tool is actually a website called KeepVid. Keepvid.com. You just paste
any URL. Likes, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. You paste any URL into the little web app. You click on a button. It will give you a URL that you can download the Flash video file from, and then convert it using whatever tool you got handy, like iSquint. It supports like 24 different video sites.
If you're gonna pay for shareware this year, pay and get the upgrade to Visual Hub from iSquint, because it totally kicks butt.
Yeah, that's an awesome.
It's an amazing app. I mean, if you're doing the kind of stuff we're talking about here, now that we're all kind of pissing from the high ground about all the developer rights, mind if we tell you a couple ways to get some media?
Free programs. There you go. Free video.
Which leads logically into my pick.
All right. Thank you, Andy.
You know, open source free software, GNU software, it always gets a bad rap for being so butt ugly, which is usually very well earned. And don't start, Andy. I'm not there yet. There is an application called, have we talked about Transmission?
Transmission
at transmissionbt.com. This is a BitTorrent application that, according to their about page, works on 5 operating systems. Now, you're thinking to yourself, I'm going to open this thing up, and it's going to be some kind of crazy Java swing thing, and it's going to make my eyes hurt, and it's going to look like old Mozilla. But this thing looks so good. I first learned about it from Chairman Gruber, I believe. If you're doing the BitTorrent, have a look at Transmission because it is such a
better than Azurius, better than Tomato Torrent, and things like that.
Open her up. This is a very cocoa looking Mac application. Wow. I don't know what's happening under the hood, but care has been taken to some of the widgets are a little non-standard looking in our increasingly fascistic UI world of the Mac. But it's really pretty and it works great and it's got a ton
growl.
Of features.
You gotta like that.
What's that?
Uses growl, so it's very Mac-ish.
And it's got you can hit this little turtle if you want to throttle the bandwidth, which is kind of cool. But and it's got a really nice little inspector that'll let you do lots of stuff. It's as free as in free. And if you do the BitTorrent, I would say have a look at it. It's got lots of options and it looks good on your Mac. It will not make your eyes hurt.
Woohoo. Woohoo.
Of course. But what will pain will it inflict upon your soul, I ask?
All I know is that it was worth it to download Horse Feathers.
When you're just 38 cents short of admission into heaven, and then you find out that stealing via BitTorrent is a lifetime fee of 50 cents, are you going to say the Transmission was a wonderful piece of software?
St. Paul says, sorry, Jack, we don't have change for a BitTorrent.
I'll do my best to get you in. You know I will, but...
Andy, you're going to be up there waiting for us, huh?
Oh, of course. Well, not waiting for you, but you know, I am in all places at all times.
I'm not waiting for anybody. I'm going straight in.
When you come to the gate, when we get there, and just intercede a little bit for us,
it'll be a not go plus. Let's call it plus 18. Yeah. I'm guessing my family members should be able to get in
before
you guys. I love you guys, but you know, the family's probably got
a not go party of 20. All right, my program is free. It will not cost you to enter the pearly gates. It's actually from my good friends Leah Culver and Kevin Rose. Pounce is finally public, and if you want to be a Pounce member, it's a Twitter clone, but with some really nice additional features. The ability to put files in there, including video and images.
That's the big difference, right? The file sharing.
Also, links and events are special. I like it. I think it's very pretty.
It's kind of Jaiku-ish, sort of.
You know, it's not because it doesn't do the RSS feeds. It's not a presence-focused thing. And the other thing, unlike Jaiku and Twitter, it's really not mobile phone-focused. And actually, my application is a true application. It's the Pounce app, which has been much updated. And I think if you like Twitterific, you'll love the Pounce app. It's really very slick. It does allow you now to send direct messages to Pounce friends. The other thing Pounce had that Twitter is now starting to add is the ability to have groups of friends that you can specifically message. I think Twitter has just started to add that feature to it. But Pounce is now public, and they have a great app, which is Windows and Mac. It's done in Adobe Air. And if you've never played with Adobe Air, you'll have to download Air first, which is a 15 meg download. But I think this is very, very slick, very pretty. You could look at it and say, even better than Twitterific, I think. So, and if you want to use Pounce, I think you probably should use the Pounce app. Certainly take a look at Pounce.
That's interesting because for me, the biggest feature of Twitter is just the fact that so many people I know are on Twitter.
I agree. And that's mostly, now you have to remember that Pounce has been closed. It's really been San Francisco, Digirati mostly. So now that it's open, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
I think that's actually one of the reasons why you see the smart things that reveal themselves only with time. I think the reasons why when you log into Twitter from the webpage, it tells you have 1,756 followers just as a little subtle warning. Yeah, that's fine. If you want to have zero followers on Pounce, by all means, leave. We'll welcome you back.
Well, I'll be the first to say that I can't.
A larger number than zero, isn't it?
I'll be the first to say, I left Twitter for Jaiku. I chose features over community, and it was a mistake. And I'm back on Twitter where, there's the community. That's absolutely the case.
I used to sniff, and I used to make fun of people who followed that kind of crap. Right now, I'm the number 8 most friended person on Twitter,
I cut you down right to size. You're the Dane Cook of Twitter.
Find that out? What site do you find
Sing!
That
out?
Do you want to know? Do you want to know? We can do a super quick survey of the total Twitter time sync apps. Twitterholic.com.
Oh, boy.
We'll show you the most followed people. But the killer app, the app that will drain your entire day.
By the way, I'm number 14, but coming on strong.
Oh, you're coming on. I've been watching you.
You've been coming up
the charts.
Watch out, Merlin. I used to have 5,000. When I left Twitter, I had 5,000.
go to, I'm going to spell this out. I think it's pronounced Favitter, but F-A-V-O-T-T-E-R
Favotter.
Matope.com.
I must have been there before because it knew immediately about that. It's in Japanese.
You're ego surfing. There's an English version too.
All right. So what is this? Oh, you're right on top there.
Well, yeah. Well, go ahead and read it out loud.
Hint for freelancers. If you keep smelling hoagies that aren't there, it's probably time to grab a quick shower. By the way, Merlin's Twitters are worth the price of admission, which is free. But absolutely a must read.
Will show you. You can see if you want to go and ego surf yourself there. I'll let you surf around to find out all you can do here. But you can basically go in and find your most favorited over time. It shows you who's favoriting your Twitters. And you can go and just basically drain all of the time out of your day.
So you're hot. What does that mean that you're the hot?
People haven't seen me yet.
So do people have to favorite you to get this?
You know what's funny? Read that red one. Go down four and read
work
aloud.
Work becomes disruptively more enjoyable if you can shed the clients who buy solely on price. Truth is, you can't afford them. Are you quoting Rich?
No, dude, this is from this morning.
Wow. Well, that's exactly what Rich was saying.
Exactly. It's so funny that was totally on my mind this morning. Yeah. And it's so funny to hear him say it that way. The stuff about
I'm just sorry our daughter has to grow up in a world where so few keyboard players still dress as surgeons.
Two of my favorite bands in the 80s had a keyboard player that dressed as a surgeon.
That's the thing about Merlin. Most of his Twitters are very 80 anchored in the 80s. You need to understand that.
Yeah, what are you Twitter about Cab Calloway? What are yours?
I'm old. I don't the 80s. I don't know what you're talking about.
Down to St. James in Flint.
Wait.
So Favitter. These are two things that will help you just basically kill your entire day. Then there's the other ones. There's that map program.
How do I get myself on Favitor?
Okay, so click on your username. Click on Hot Dogs Ladies.
First of all, it's F-A-V-O-T-T.
Favotter. Yeah.
.matope.com.
I don't get it, though.
M-A-T-O-P-E.
I have no presence on Favotter. I'm depressed.
I'm going to send you one of my Earls, and you can just switch out your name.
Mm-hmm. Now, I must throw the BS flag on this because Twitter says that I'm number 17 at 1,700 and something. I should be number 55, 56 on Twitterholic, but I'm not anywhere on the list.
Well, Twitterholic.
What I can tell you about Favitor is that I think the dude is. I don't quite understand this because it's a little bit.
One person has faved any of my stuff.
Now, what he's doing is, I don't quite understand how he does this, but I think it's people who have had posts favorited the most get their votes counted more.
Which is why I'm not on here. But what's the color have to do?
That's how hot it is, whether it's green or purple or red.
There's nothing about
it. Or so
color.
I hear, but I don't really follow this very carefully.
So I have three faves on my hottest one. See, you're like, you got thousands of people favoring you.
Well, that's because I got nothing to do, Leo. You're out there making stuff where you can go, hey,
your new medium.
Let's have this be the flag quote for this episode. I've got nothing to do, says Merlin Man, brand new parent. Mrs. Man is a very, very lucky woman, wouldn't you say?
My wife is on the Twitter. Hers are great.
Your wife is on the Twitter?
Can you get that thing to pipe down? I'm trying to boil this down to 140 characters.
I want to add your wife. How can I add your wife to
Mad Man? M-A-D-M-A-N.
Your wife. How much for the little girl?
I want her on Twitter.
Could you guys please keep it down? I'm trying to formulate a 140 character joke about Night Ranger.
Sister Christian. Does Eleanor yet have a Twitter?
Eleanor does not have one, but I know a lot of people do. I know Arlo. Our friend Jen and Jeff's kid has one. I think, you know, Gruber's kid should have his own. Gruber's wife, Amy Jane is her name, is hilarious. You should definitely
really Amy Jane. All right. See, I got it. See, I have
okay. You know what? For next week, can I suggest this? Next week, I've done this before and I really believe in this. Next week, we should each come back with three people that we nominate as who people should follow.
No!
Yes.
Why does everything have to be like MySpace? Hey, can you friend me? I'll friend you back.
No. This
Loser
is legitimate.
Boy.
All right,
Loser old. Boy.
I think your
hat's getting tight, Andy.
it was all about the music one day. Remember when it was all about the music?
You've changed, man.
Sister Christian of the night is... All right. Let's wrap this sucker up because we're about to descend into 80s nostalgia, and I can't allow that to happen. Ladies and gentlemen, I thank Andy Iannacco, who is now online with the celestial waste of bandwidth. Do you want to tell people how to get there?
Yes. You get your interweb browser, type CWOB.com into the URL address line, hit return, think happy thoughts. That has nothing to do with loading the page, but I think you deserve happy thoughts.
You need www on your CWOB.com.
Just don't refer to it as the www.
And I like the picture of you.
Love that picture.
Where is that? That's very funny.
That is hanging in the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
And by the way, great new pictures thanks to Ranger Craig of Alcatraz on Andy's Flickr account.
My good thanks to Ranger Craig of the National Park Service, who gave me in exchange for my helping him out on the on some things he's putting together. Get ready to bookmark this. It's not up yet, but get ready. Just put an empty space in your podcast bookmarks for the Alcatraz podcast, podcast originating from Alcatraz.
I'm going to get out of this joint one day. And when I do, you're all dead.
Screws. If you try to unsubscribe, somebody shoots you.
My body may belong to you, but my soul belongs to Jesus. So it was awesome. We spent like about 20-30 minutes like looking at his podcast and giving me some advice, some of which hopefully was useful, some of which I'm sure he already knew because he's a very, very savvy guy. He's like the internet guy at The Rock.
That's cool.
And then took me around all public places, all kinds of places that you can't get into. The extremely spooky dungeon underneath Alcatraz. It turns out that the movie was not a lie. It was built over a Civil War citadel, so there are basements and stuff that go back 150 years. It seems like a bad place to be left, and I'm very grateful to him for all sorts of things, but also for not leaving me there.
You did that thing. You did that thing where you went and closed the door.
Yes, where the darkest. Yeah, exactly. You're in this, and there are pictures there on my Flickr feed. You can see it from CWB.com. But you're in this place where they used to keep conscientious objectors back in the First World War, when conscientious objectors were the most hated thing you could possibly be. It was also the place where if you misbehaved in Alcatraz and they thought that, no, Alcatraz is too nice for you, we're going to put you in the dungeon for 19 days, because legally we can put you there for 19. If we want to put you there for 20 days, we have to file paperwork, but we can just decide to put you there for 19 days. That's where they put you. And Craig, he's not a cruel person, so he asked if it was okay if I wanted to do this, and I eagerly assented. Went into one of the little cell that the conscientious objectors would stay in. Then you hear him walking away. They're like little work lights that keep the thing barely illuminated, and then you hear him walking away. And then you hear the steel door close, and then he turns off all the lights. And it's just like having a brainstem injury where you can't hearing.
Do they allow parents to bring their teenagers to this? Because I think I could use that.
The interesting thing, and this will send us down a rat hole, but it was largely abandoned for a long time, and there was a occupation by Indians who were making a very, very important point, and did a very, very successful protest.
So it's
not like it was this museum that was preserved the way it was in 1963. There have been people in and out of this place. You'll see graffiti. He was telling me about some people, sometimes they rented out, they used to rent it out for movie and TV show shoots. And I guess this is the funniest story from the entire tour. I guess they had a big crew. They're filming, I think it was actually a Streets of San Francisco or something like that. And it's a big, the base, the dungeon is a big, big place with all these little rooms. I guess like two or three people in the crew decided to during downtime, do a little moonlight, do a little side project. And so there is a gay porno film that was actually filmed in the dungeons, dungeons of Alcatraz.
Oh,
and
Wynn
Martin production.
Listeners, I invite you there in the car to, after the podcast, this podcast is nearly over. After it's done, spend 5 or 10 minutes thinking up good names for a gay porno film filmed in Alcatraz. But I got to say this one last thing before I let you go, because there is a photo in this photo series of Ranger Craig with his phone. I don't know how the hell he was doing this, but he was getting tweets on his phone in the dungeons underneath Alcatraz. And believe you me, the next time I'm at my sister's house and I can't get one single bar of coverage, I'm going to be thinking about being in a dungeon underneath Alcatraz, the most hostile federal penitentiary in the world, and getting three bars worth of tweets as I was going on. And
they probably have a cell site on Alcatraz. That'd be a good place to put a cell site.
They must. Next to my sister's house would be another good place to put a cell site, but apparently federal prisoners get better cell service than my sister does. They haven't met my sister. Maybe they might have a point, but...
Well, Merlin, maybe you and Matt could bring Eleanor. I'll bring the teenagers, and we could do a family picnic in the dungeon.
I would not mind putting a little bit of fear into that girl. I'm 12 weeks old. I'm too young to put in a dungeon.
Think of it prophylactically.
Absolutely. You got to take preventative measures.
Your father said we can let you out when you're 33.
19 days. I think actually we were saying before we went on air that that is the best touristy thing. And the Golden Gate are the two, like, don't miss.
Well, now we got an in. We can see more stuff. All right, I'm going to wrap this up because I got to move on to more podcasts. I can't believe it. Merlin Mann is at 43folders.com, and I'm so glad you're back. Both of you, it's been good to have you on the show. An amazingly interesting show. We also want to thank Rich Siegel at barebones.com for coming in and talking a little bit about Mack Heiston. I have a feeling next week we will hear some rebuttals. We'll see you then. Another Mack break is broke.